I feel so strongly about this. I think that early psychoanalytic writing really overemphasized the value of separation individuation and minimized or pathologized the opposite. And it's been through personal experience that I have come to see that in a different way. Personal experience, both with regard to, I'm Jewish, with regard to Jewish commemorative ritual, which takes place a couple of times a year, but also some experiences that I had outside the realm of religion. And the one that pops to mind, because it happened not that long ago, was what President Biden did about a year after the first onslaught of the COVID epidemic, which was that he had candles put all around the reflecting pool in DC. And I think one candle for every number of people who had died. And this was broadcast on television. Now, maybe because I hadn't actually lost anybody to COVID, so I had a little bit thicker skin, but I sat there and first I wept, thousands of deaths, right? And then I began to think about the power of the experience of mourning with other like subjects. Because despite the fact that we all had lost whomever we lost, we didn't all lose the same person, we had all lost somebody to this virus that was not as yet being managed. And there was something incredibly powerful about that, in the same way that I have been told people who lost somebody in 9/11 go down to the Twin Towers and read the list of names every year. We don't know how to theorize this stuff, but I think it's time that we did.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful. And I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Joyce Schlockhauer. Dr. Schlockhauer is a psychoanalyst, and she's a professor emerita of psychology at Hunter College and at the Graduate Center of City University of New York. She's on the faculty of the NYU postdoctoral program, the Stephen Mitchell Center, and the National Training Program at NIP, the Philadelphia Center for Relational Studies, and at PINC in San Francisco. She writes widely and lectures internationally. Her books include Holding and Psychoanalysis, A Relational Perspective, and Psychoanalytic Collisions, and co-editor with Lou Aaron and Sue Grand of a book called De-idealizing Relational Theory, A Critique from Within, and Decentering Relational Theory, A Comparative Critique. Her recent book, which is the topic of our conversation today, is sort of provocatively titled, Psychoanalysis and the Unspoken. And we cover a lot of territory today. She shares with us the trajectory of her thinking over her long career, how it has evolved from being what she calls a young analyst to being a senior analyst now. We cover the topic of what she calls analytic delinquencies, and she will describe what she means by that. The topic of post-treatment contact between patient and analyst, and what that tells us about our understanding of transference resolution. Also the topic of aging and the blessings and limitations that it provides for us all. And she also makes a point towards the end of sharing with us her thoughts about commemorative ritual, group commemorative ritual. And she challenges the idea, the commonplace analytic idea, that anything that's ritualized sort of deadens the experience. And she speaks about how it can reaffirm the creative experience and attachment to those people and the ideals that are important to us. It's a wide-ranging conversation. I really highly recommend the book. It's an easy read, but the ease isn't because it's in any way a lightweight read. It's quite substantive. She just happens to write very well, so it's an easy read. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Dr. Joyce Schlockauer. Joyce, welcome to the podcast. So glad to have you. Joyce, by the title of your book, Psychoanalysis and the Unspoken, you've invited us into the paradox, whereby analysts sans are privileged to discover free association, the freedom to try to say everything that's in their mind. Analysts, on the other hand, are limited by the constraints of conventionality. And with that, you bring to our attention the unspoken, the many areas where we fool ourselves with our illusions of honesty. And we're going to consider three areas that you address in your book, though there are more in the book. And I mean this just to tease the listener to want to read more and more. But the three areas that we're going to focus on is what you delightfully called analytic delinquencies, post-treatment contacts, and aging, everybody's favorite subject. But before we do that, I'm going to invite you to read a paragraph that precedes those three topics and is in a section in the book entitled Holding, which we're not going to spend time on, though it'll be worth everyone's while. And this I am inviting you to read for two reasons. Number one, it lets everyone know a characteristic of your writing, you and the book, which is there's a transparency that you share with us. You're being very honest about yourself, but notably, for my taste, not excessively transparent, which has its own stories.
What am I not confessing?
Exactly, right. And the other theme it introduces is the issue of the maturing analyst, which is a thread that runs throughout the book. And this, I think, is a wonderful, if not challenging, introduction. Why don't you start us off?
Okay. As a young analyst, I tried hard to meet my patients where they were. When I was 39, I arranged for a suicidal patient to phone me daily while I was out of the country on vacation. She relied on the ongoing calls, stayed out of the hospital, and ultimately got better. I described that work in a number of different places. The contact seemed essential given Sarah's suicidality. Indeed, it never really occurred to me to do otherwise. A few years later, another patient, not so much regressed as massively anxious and urgent, managed time between our three weekly sessions by leaving me long phone messages on my pre-digital answering machine. That dates me and may date some of you listeners. She often ran out my tape. I didn't mind much. I was aware of her desperation and need for containment. And she too got better. Today, I'd mind doing both. I'm far more cognizant of my own clinical personal limits and more aware of the problematic edge to a kind of responsiveness that once felt simply necessary. Of the risk that my patient will become reliant on my soothing capacity in a way that truncates her own. That I'll participate in a fantasy that has its own dynamic underpinnings for us both.
Now, that's such an important characterization and trajectory. You were doing something that was profoundly helpful, so you recount, to a very fragile person. and now you've decided not to do such things. That leaves the obvious question is, do the things you do now, are they helpful for such patients in a different way? Or do you refer such patients? Or what do you do with this question, which is that the method you found worked, but I'm not doing it anymore?
Well, that may be a little bit of an overstatement. I wouldn't say I'm not doing it anymore, like full stop.
I imagine, yeah.
But what I did there, I don't do anymore. And I think that there are a multiplicity of reasons why. And these are not in order. They're just in the order that they occur to me. I was young. I was sort of so taken with the psychoanalytic vision that I had been trained in, and so eager to, and I use this word advisedly, save or rescue my patients, whatever it took, that it never really dawned on me to say, hey, wait a minute, how do I feel about this? So a piece of that was youth and what I think of as the excesses of youthful enthusiasm. Another piece of it had to do with the fact that I came to recognize that there's an underbelly to that kind of, let us say, therapeutic excess, which is the following. If I spend all my time kind of putting my finger in the emotional dike of a patient who is having difficulty and pay no attention to their own capacity for self-regulation or the possibility that they could begin to build some resilience, I do perpetuate a dynamic in which they remain dependent on me. And there's a downside to that, one piece of it, of which is one day I'm not going to be here anymore. And I would like to think that they're going to be able to carry forward some of this work with themselves, not only with another analyst. And hooked into that and implicit there is, I'm not as young as I once was, alas. Mm-hmm. And there are things that I feel now that I didn't feel then. Didn't bother me to get up at, I used to get up at like 5:30 a.m. in Europe to take these calls while my family was asleep. Well, I wake up at 5:30 now anyway, so that part wouldn't matter. But if it were 9 at night, it's like, forget about it. Not happening. I'm cooked. And that's age. And I think we have to take that seriously. You know, we really do develop different limits as we age. And I think in part, I'm talking about that. But the other part is theoretical. I think the excess of the Winnicottian model was that it did not, he certainly talked about the move from object relating to object usage in terms of the capacity of the subject to recognize the otherness of the object. But he did not talk about the downside of the kind of near absolute dependence that he associated with regression. And I think there's a downside.
Very helpfully said. Thank you. Let's dive into the section that you called the analyst's secret delinquencies. Let me read what you've written about it, and then I'm going to ask you about your experiences with it. You write, by characterizing some therapeutic action as delinquencies, I'm focusing on those professional behaviors that are secretly and often guiltily enacted. I use the term delinquencies to refer to moments when we momentarily, but with apparently conscious intent, deliberately disengage from the treatment process to satisfy a personal need. Although some delinquencies occur during face-to-face sessions, it's my impression that most are intentionally hidden, committed either when a patient is on the couch or during phone or virtual sessions. In minor and more egregious ways, we exploit an opportunity to secretly withdraw affectively and/or cognitively from our patients. In so doing, we violate implicit professional norms but keep that violation to ourselves. You go on to say, I locate delinquencies along a continuum marked by major boundary violations at one pole and enactments on the other. In contrast to the spontaneous affective eruption that typically characterizes enactments, most misdemeanors are deliberately committed and contain less affective charge. The analyst isn't engaged in reverie, but in purposeful inattention. In this sense, delinquencies aren't unlike more serious boundary violations. However, where major boundary violations involve explicit exploitation of the patient, misdemeanors usually reflect the analyst's attentional and affective withdrawal from the arena of patient need into a state of solipsistic subjecthood, so that the analyst becomes the single subject in the room. Want to start us off with that?
Sure. And I think where I would start is with what I just mentioned there, because I mostly wrote this book before COVID, which is that working virtually, which many of us initially were forced to do because we had no option during COVID, and have continued to do for a complex number of reasons, including patient need, but at least equally our convenience, right? Like here I am in California talking to you. And I'm going to be here all week and I'm going to see patients virtually because my kids are here and I can do it. In olden days, I couldn't do it. So one of the things that virtual work does is it truly invites the kinds of delinquencies that I'm talking about. The other day, a colleague kind of confessed to me, I didn't even know this. Do you know that you can minimize, you can't do it on FaceTime, but on Zoom, you can minimize a screen and go onto a totally different window and nobody can tell?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so you can. So a colleague told me that she was trying to get a very good airfare and the thing wouldn't load. And she was like, urgent to get the airfare. So halfway through the session, she minimized the screen, went back onto whatever it was, Google Flights or something, found it, bought it, and went back to the patient.
Uh-huh.
Okay, that's a delinquency. She was gone for, I don't know, 30 seconds, 45 seconds. It was deliberate. It reflected her personal need. I do not think it was an enactment in that I do not think it was stimulated or precipitated by the patient or her countertransference. It reflected her personal urgency, which was to get this cheap airfare before they upped it again.
Notably, you make a comment, and I don't know the age of this colleague you're talking about, but when you have had this conversation with younger colleagues, you write that they uniformly responded with outrage and shock. But older analysts, you say you spoke with, responded with recognition and some amusement.
Right. Yeah, when I first gave this paper a million years ago to audiences like all over the world, and I just got a list of confessions that's too long. I didn't put them all in the book.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Everything from people watching a sports scoreboard online while on the call to secretly writing a grocery list to texting with somebody, all people whom I would have called responsible, ethical, good analysts. In other words, I wasn't talking to people whom I thought of as psychopaths, which makes the whole thing particularly interesting. Like, why were they doing this? And I just had a rant, actually. I was giving a talk someplace, and I had a rant. I mean, not really a rant, but I had a little bit of a rant around the fact that many of us schedule our sessions back to back, which means that unless a patient is late, when do you pee?
Right. Yes, I know.
And I have had people tell me that they, not on Zoom, but if they're on the phone, they have muted the phone to go pee. That's, you know, the problem with that, aside from the fact that it's sort of disturbing, is what is up that you can't say to the patient, excuse me, I need to use the bathroom. I'll be back in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
We are holding ourselves to a kind of non-human standard as if we don't have a body.
To my knowledge, this, call it delinquencies or any other name, has not been written about or widely acknowledged. And that's why I think your book is important and our conversation is important, because I think there are many people listening who will feel a sense of relief that, oh, it's talked about, or, oh, I'm not the only one who does this. Not sure quite what they will do next with it, but at least the sense of familiarity and freedom to acknowledge it will be there.
Well, I like that, but I would like it if it also took them to a place of, why am I doing this? What can I do with me to meet my basic needs so that I don't have to sneak during sessions? That's what I would hope would be the next step.
And referring back to your transparency, do you want to read your own example of this, which you're generous enough to share with the reader on page 81?
Over the weekend, and this one I do have to interrupt myself to say, this one is so minor.
Yes, that I know it is. Right.
You could call it courageous, but I think compared to some of the things I just mentioned.
I understand, yes.
It's like, okay. Over the weekend, I had found an old photo of my now grown-up daughter, in whose house I am, about 10 at the time. The picture showed her smiling hugely and looking utterly adorable, and I slipped it into a pile on my desk, planning to put it into an album later. During a session with a quiet, hardworking analytic patient who's engaged with me in a low-key way, I impulsively picked up the photo and smiled at my daughter's aliveness and youthful beauty. For perhaps 10 seconds, I was suffused with a sense of warmth and personal pleasure as I returned to an earlier time and imagined cuddling her and sharing her joy. This was stolen pleasure. I briefly but quasi-deliberately removed myself from my patient, although I didn't lose track of his process.
So, granted, this is not a major delinquency, as you say, and you say you didn't lose track of his process. My imagining is that if you asked or had conversations with people who do this more regularly, they would say the same thing to you, that they don't lose track of the process.
And I think that's probably true for some and not for others. In other words, I think that taking a look at a picture or maybe writing down milk because you suddenly realize that you're out of milk is something that can be done without really leaving the patient behind. I think if you're into sports and you're watching a sports scoreboard, I don't know. I mean, I'm not into sports, so I don't really know. But it seems to me that you would get more involved in the game than in what the patient is saying.
Now, we have to acknowledge that on a good day, when someone finds themselves thinking of a shopping list, much less getting milk, they would consider that that is an association to what's happening in the room. And oftentimes that's true enough. Mm-hmm. But you're carving out, if I hear you right, a separate category where not that it isn't necessarily born or influenced by the unconscious material between the two people, but that for whatever reason, the analyst isn't using it for that purpose. They're using it just to make a grocery list.
Right. So that certainly when we have associations to things personal, the first thing that we are supposed to do is to say, all right, what's going on here? Mm-hmm. What has my patient said that has brought this up in my mind? What am I feeling about my patient? What might my patient be unconsciously communicating to me? What might I be communicating to my patient by virtue of my temporary inattention? And that is the category that I think analysts across the theoretical spectrum take seriously and know how to work with. What I'm trying to suggest in a way is a pushback against the excesses of the notion that everything is intersubjective. I don't think that everything is intersubjective. I mean, you could argue that if somebody really has to pee, it's the patient's material. I would be, since this is the first thing that happens to me, more likely to argue, it's the coffee, stupid.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are things that we do that have to do with our own need for self-regulation that may not reflect something interactive.
Tell us about Dr. M, your supervisee, with whom you introduced this section.
So she was, I mean, this is a long time ago now, of course. She was maybe 40, early 40s. And one of these people who, and this is very important, by the way, she came to me for private supervision. I supervise at analytic institutes around. I have never gotten a confession like this from somebody who was in a training program, which I don't think is surprising.
Right.
So she's in private supervision with me, and she comes in and very embarrassedly tells me that she was on the phone with a patient, this was in pre-Zoom days, and quietly turning the pages of a magazine because her patient was boring. He just kind of like droned. And then the patient heard the page turn and asked her what she was doing, and she said she was taking notes. So she not only committed a delinquency by looking at a magazine, she committed a second by lying. And she came in sort of racked with guilt, much more guilt than curiosity, I would add, which interestingly puts the supervisor in a very particular position, right? Because her guilt is going to shut down self-examination. So I need, if we're going to do anything with this, I need first to create a space that is characterized more by curiosity and inquiry than by finger wagging. And that can be tricky. So I mean, because I knew her, liked her, she liked me, we had a long history, I was able to do it. And I said, okay, I don't remember what I said, so this is a facsimile. You know, you didn't kill your patient. Yeah, nothing horrible happened. Can we try to think about what was going on between you and the patient that led you to turn the pages of a magazine? And that example illustrates the opposite side of the delinquencies dilemma, because there I located her, whatever you want to call it, delinquency in her reaction to the patient. In other words, it wasn't simply that she had to pee. She was working with somebody who was incredibly boring. And she sort of tried to keep herself alive by looking at pictures, which doesn't make it okay, but it locates it more in the interpersonal, intersubjective realm than many of the examples that I talked about there.
Fair to say into the world of meaning as opposed to sin?
Yeah, although I would love it if we could just X out the word sin and leave it in Washington.
Well said. So we'll double down on meaning and curiosity. Oh, that works, right. And but then it developed further. With her, you said you were pleased, and both of you, or you more so, felt a sense of satisfaction that her learning to do something different with this particular patient and how to manage the boredom seemed like a nice supervisory insight, only to learn
that she did it all the time.
Right.
So we then came to something that goes more in the direction of self-regulation. And this one, incidentally, I think is probably more characteristic of younger analysts, therapists, because they work too hard. You know, we get to the point, I'm at a point where, like, I don't work Friday afternoons. Forget it. I don't. Young people who are both hungrier financially and, you know, more ambitious are often taking on, as I am told, 50 hours a week, which in my opinion is too many hours. So they're in a position where the only way to get something for oneself feels like to steal it. And I think that that is why we see this kind of thing differently across the, if you will, the developmental trajectory of the analyst. I'm much more likely at this point in time, as I just did, because I'm out in California for the week, because I am, to say to my patients, I'm going to be out of the city. If there is an emergency, I will be available and working on Wednesday next week. It's a communication that says, I'm not really working, but if there's an emergency, you can get me.
Right.
In the olden days, I would have gotten here. I still have a friend who does this. She gets up for her 7:45 patient at 4:45 because she's on the East Coast, on the West Coast now.
Right.
And I think that's nuts.
Well, to be more particular than nuts, you're saying, assuming it's not driven exclusively by financial need, you're saying it's by a difficulty in putting limits and saying no to the patient.
Saying no to the patient and also parallel to that, saying to oneself, what do I need as a person to function effectively as an analyst?
You conclude this section, and let me read it, by saying, delinquencies disrupt the treatment contract and represent a real failure of the analytic function. Yet they also reflect our abiding and immutable humanity, the limits of our ability to fully suspend personal needs in the context of a requirement that we do so. The analytic ideal contains a disregard for those dimensions of our humanness that are not integral to the treatment relationship. Misdemeanors are ubiquitous precisely because we find it so difficult to acknowledge and work with the clash between our very human selfishness and the still excessive demands of this impossible profession. We need to contend with this paradox. To simultaneously embrace the analytic ideal, its collision with our own very real and limiting humanity, and our commitment to sustaining an ongoing struggle against the abandonment of that ideal. Rather nicely said.
Thank you. You know, when you were reading it, I had an association, which was, it's in someplace in the book, I think, to a friend who was in analysis with a reasonably senior guy, and he, the analyst, had lunch during their sessions. And he asked the patient, my friend, if he minded, and my friend being my friend said no, which is, of course, itself should have been subject to analysis.
You would think, right.
One would think. But the question, which is almost more important, is what was this guy doing when he was having lunch in the sessions? Well, he deprived himself of a lunch hour. So either he was starving and couldn't listen, desperate to fill every hour of his day. And frankly, I don't care whether it was because of money or ambition or whatever.
Sure.
It is an absence of self-care. And this runs through our profession in a big way, that somehow we don't feel entitled to the ordinary things that people should be entitled to, like when you have to pee, you have to pee. And if you have to say to the patient, excuse me, I need to use the bathroom, I'll be back in a minute, do it. Mm. Most people don't do it.
Segueing on to a related topic of self-satisfactions, you have a section of the book called Sequels.
Mm-hmm.
And this concerns the area of post-treatment contact between analyst and analysand.
Mm-hmm.
Now, just to make it simpler, you're not really talking about candidates who graduate and are then part of the institute and may or may not be sitting on committees. That's a different subject from what you've written about. What you're writing about is freed from those definitions and constraints. What do the two people do if one or both of them would like to have post-treatment contact?
I actually don't think I'm making that distinction. I think I'm saying it's true for both groups.
I know what you mean. I'm trying to find the intent within the people as opposed to how to deal with the structure that encourages it. The structure
okay.
that will put them on a committee, then they have to decide what to do vis-a-vis the committee. But they each have to decide if they're going to go out for dinner together.
True.
And you write about this, again, in what I have come to appreciate as a beautifully even-handed way. You write, on an interpersonal level, turning a circumscribed transference-based relationship into a, quote, real relationship crosses a challenging line. The asymmetry characteristic of the treatment setup may remain a shadow presence that colors, even skews, the newly constructed friendship. An overtly platonic friendship could, for example, obscure an underlying sexual element. Alternatively, the treatment's therapeutic dimension may be carried forward into the friendship so that the patient continues to, quote, be a patient, to rely on the ex-analyst for symbolic parental support, advice, even interpretations, albeit over coffee or a meal. At other times, this dynamic reverses so that the analyst turns to the patient for help or support. Either way, idealizations, asymmetrical or shared, probably remain a shadow presence. Tell us about your thoughts about this.
Well, I think that I would begin with the statement that I dare an institute to declare this has never happened. I think it hasn't happened for every analyst, but it is so extraordinarily common that the thing that's kind of shocking is that we haven't addressed it. that it really is not talked about unless it becomes sexual. I mean, I vividly remember being at, I think it was Division 39, and walking out of the meeting with some friends and seeing a very senior analyst whom we all knew go into a restaurant with somebody whom we all knew, because there is no secrecy or privacy in this field of ours, with a former patient. And we all went, can you believe, look who's having lunch with their ex-analyst, mm-hmm. right? Of course, it never got acknowledged or talked about. It is so common. And
let me ask you, never got acknowledged or talked about between or among whom?
As far as I know, anybody.
Other than in gossip.
Yeah, lots and lots of gossip. But it wasn't as if the patient ever said to anybody, I have no idea, of course, what the ex-patient really mm-hmm. said to the analyst or vice versa, that I can't know. It wasn't there. Mm-hmm. But the perception was that they were operating under the assumption that nobody knew about their previous relationship, and so there was nothing to tell. It happens when the ex-analyzand is not in the field too, particularly in small towns. I remember Bill McGillivray talking about how, I think he lives in Knoxville, mm-hmm. which is someplace in the part of the country that I can't find on a map.
Not that small, but I get your point.
Okay. It's like, where is it? Yeah. Knoxville, Tennessee?
Tennessee, yeah.
Okay. Anyway, he said it happens all the time, and it can happen all the time because there's one supermarket and three restaurants and so on. There are a couple of questions there that I think we really need to ask. One is this a problem? Or should we be able to say a good termination ends the therapeutic relationship? And if the two have something in common, it's not the end of the world to continue a relationship as long as it's talked about. Or is that baloney because once a patient, always a patient? And I would tell you a story there, which I think is kind of funny, which is I was the chair of ethics committee for Division 39 for a long time. And we tried to put through the board, to get the board to approve a statement. And we were talking sex, okay, so it was worse, that it is unethical to have a sexual relationship with an ex-patient across the lifetime of both parties. And a fairly long meeting ended up with an absolute refusal. It did not go through. It was not approved. And from what I know, indirectly, it's been approved by the American Psychiatric, by, I think, the American Psychoanalytic, although I'm less sure, the social work organization as well. Something about us psychologists that seem particularly resistant to that. So what is that about?
Do you want to read, you write so nicely again on both sides of the issue on page 108 on this topic in their best iteration.
Yep. And this is the pro argument.
Right.
And I'm going to say one more thing before I read it, which I find most interesting, that I have a bunch of Freudian friends who are, they're old. They're like,
that's
all
quite a
old
category. I have Freudian friends, but all right.
I do. I mean, listen, yeah. My parents are Freudian analysts. I grew up with them.
Okay.
But a couple of these folks, they're in their 80s. Okay. They've been doing this for a long time and I respect them. They're not, they're not dinosaurs. They're, you know, seasoned, reasonable people. And they do it. They're like, what's the problem? The patient terminated. Relationalists and interpersonalists are much more cautious, which I find most amusing.
Well, just to pick up on that, avoiding the category of relationalist or Freudian, I think the idea that transferences resolve and go away is a long ago fiction. Whatever your religious ideology happens to be. I mean, we all know, I mean, the beauty of the model of compromise formations is that we're all living in them all the time. Now, and our goal is to help them be more adaptive in life. Mm-hmm. Now, they could then say, yes, of course there's transference in everything, but it's not a problem. But you say it better in your writing. So why don't you
share that?
Yeah.
Okay. In their best iteration, our attachments enrich life while leaving us free to go our own way. My treatment relationships sometimes mirror this configuration. Could the analyst-patient dyad develop a post-termination relationship indicative not of unresolved transference issues, but rather a move beyond the transference? Might some post-analytic friendships reflect growth and maturity rather than residual need? Might both patient and analyst sometimes have the capacity to move past the transference relationship? Transference-based fantasies don't always simply get worked through and resolved. They sometimes transform in ways that reflect personal and dyadic maturity. Just as some adult children become friends to their parents and leave dependents behind, and I would interject, not all, some ex-dyads may develop a relationship beyond the reenacted transference element, a relationship that's genuinely mutual and egalitarian.
And you go on the next page, and I'll read that, and you say, or is this going too far? Can the transference be fully resolved and the patient will leave behind the longings, conflicts, and anxieties it evoked? Can the ex-patient experience the analyst as a new object without the transference element? What about patients' need to mourn the loss of the analyst as a valuable emotional process in its own right? These two themes, the need to mourn and work through loss and to sustain attachments across time, are, after all, both central analytic goals. And I would add to that the idea that while a patient is in treatment, that they maintain the possibility of being a friend after treatment will inexorably change the treatment and the termination.
Absolutely. On the other hand, the model is lodged in a kind of idealization of the Margaret Mahler model. We aim for separation and individuation.
But we never achieve it.
No, we never achieve it, but it still steps aside from what the infant researchers have sort of reminded us, which is that a whole other dimension of development, which is equally important and valuable, is our capacity to sustain deep and mutual attachment, right? And they kind of collide.
We're going to get to that in what I think is a very unique contribution of yours in the book, which has to do with collective mourning rituals. Before we get to that, I do want to bring to our listeners' attention that you write about this issue of post-treatment contact. In more than 40 years of analytic practice, I've never even considered becoming friends with an ex-patient, even with ex-analysands who are in the field. Now, when I read that, I circled that, as I tend to do, and I said, you didn't mean you never considered it, because my sense is you have a very active imagination. And you can imagine it. Fantasized, right.
I didn't, when I said considered, I meant in a conscious way. Can I do this?
A way involving behavior and intent.
Yes.
Yes, got it. Finally, the subject of aging, which we've been speaking of since the beginning. And you have a wonderful title for it. You say, getting better all the time, ?
It's the Beatles.
Yeah, right, I know. Not everybody listening will know that. Why don't you read us on page 134, where you reflect upon getting better all the time, ?
Yep. Here's a paradox. I've never felt better about my work. I trust my analytic intuition. I work deeply and with far more ease than in earlier years. I have a sense of clinical wisdom that I certainly lacked as a young analyst. When I don't know what's going on, I can stay in the process without the kind of anxiety that plagues my younger supervisees. Yes, yet it's also clear that aging has had other less appealing effects. I can, for example, forget what I came into the room looking for, forget whether I've told somebody something already or not. I can fail to record payments or record one incorrectly. While I've always been a bit forgetful in these ways, I suspect I forget more often now. Even if that's not the case, I get more anxious about it when I do. I try to preemptively manage my anxiety by owning my mistakes, sometimes joking about the effects of aging on memory. My supervisees and patients smile, nod, and say little. They, too, are invested in preserving my intactness.
You go on to talk about your colleagues, and you say that I spoke to 21 of my older colleagues and asked them how they see their clinical theory and use of it to have changed over time. You write, there was a broad consensus that we're better analysts now than we were. We've been around the block, we're far more skilled, we're wiser, have better timing, more emotional resilience than we did in earlier years. We're more comfortable with our intuitive knowing because it's backed by decades of experience. We don't need to find theory before we move clinically because theory is in our bones. All this usually, but not always, makes us better analysts. Aging can also bring with it a different kind of maturity linked to an intensified awareness of time and endings. We're more cognizant of life's limits, the actuality of lost opportunities, the inevitability of death, in a way that we weren't in our 40s. All this is good, and not. On one hand, it helps us help people with their own existential anxieties, with the threat or reality of illness, aging, and dying, if we can deal with our own fears. But it's also likely that our own existential anxieties will be activated along with our patients. For those whose personal ghosts have been undermourned and underprocessed, aging intensifies their presence. Awareness of lost opportunities, envy of younger patients and colleagues, regret in its many forms, foreclose a sense of generativity. We become preoccupied with our past and frightened of our future. You go on to talk about this in more detail, and I want to mention just one phrase that you used. You say, we're less likely to pay close attention to the impact of self-disclosure on our patients. Mm-hmm. And I'm talking about a looseness that is not merely embedded in our theory or in our commitment to intersubjective engagement. It is a looseness that emerges out of a kind of disengagement from an earlier sense of therapeutic discipline. I'll read that again. It emerges out of a kind of disengagement from an earlier sense of therapeutic discipline, perhaps some self-indulgence. Both may reflect our intensified longing for contact, a longing informed by our awareness of the ticking clock. Can you elaborate this rich sentence of a kind of disengagement from an earlier sense of therapeutic discipline?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, I can use myself, but I really think it's extremely common, if not ubiquitous. You know, it just happened 2 weeks ago. I'm very lucky. I would consider myself very lucky in that I have no Trump supporting patients, not a one. But after the election, every patient in my practice literally came in and looked at me with great intensity and said, "So how are you doing?" one way or another. And we then slid into a conversation about the election. This conversation was driven equally, if not more, by my distress. I didn't ask them, why are you asking, or what do you feel about it, or, you know, how worried are you? We just talked about the disaster that we were afraid was befalling this country. I think in earlier years that I would not have done that. And I am not sure, on the one hand, I don't really think it was particularly terrible. I don't feel guilty about it. Had I done it 30 years ago, I would have felt guilty about it. To me, at this point in my career, those moments, I mean, it wasn't a whole session, but let's say it was 10 minutes of sort of sharing a like subject experience is both gratifying, and that's the personal piece, in some way humanizes the analytic relationship, and comes out of a sense of comfort with boundaries that allows me to use them more loosely than I did. And somebody could argue with all that, I would add.
I'm not arguing. I'm drawn to, you're saying what you said is literally the second time I've heard that sentence said today. I was at a prior meeting. And it's the sentence, I'm so lucky I don't have any Trump supporters.
Yep.
And I'm, of everything you said about this topic, I'm most interested in that, as mm-hmm. if that topic, the difference politically, isn't essential in some way for our analytic work. It's too easy. It's too seductive to delight in sharing those bad guys. Mm-hmm. I'm not debating whether they are or aren't bad guys. That's not the point. The point is that we're missing something. And it comes up in many other areas. You know, Trump in this country is easy. Try talking about Israel-Gaza with somebody.
Oh, yes, I have somebody.
Right. I understand that. So I actually am looking for someone to interview who brings a thoughtful analytic perspective to how one deals with patients whose political points of view you abhor.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean the word abhor.
I hear it. I think it's a great question. And I think that it reflects, I don't know about the person you spoke to before, but to me, it reflects my personal failure or my personal limit. I'm really good at containment, or maybe I'm really not good at it, which is why I wrote so much about holding, but I've gotten better over the years. My capacity to self-regulate around right-wing politics is very limited. And I do not have confidence in my ability not to get so dysregulated that I would not do a good job.
And there are so many people who get dysregulated, certainly with right-wing politics and also with left-wing politics, especially in this country. Yeah. So that's what I mean by people who work with patients whose politics they abhor. I unfortunately heard about somebody who just delivered a paper about it, but unfortunately it's not in English and they are not fluent in English, but I will remain on the lookout. I do want to get to this topic of yours that you wrote that is, I think, important. And that is what you call the dynamic function of commemorative ritual.
Mm-hmm.
And you say that, like religion and ongoing acts of mourning and memorials, are traditionally viewed as a sign of psychopathology, as regressive rather than integrative. You say that commemorative rituals are aimed neither at decathexis nor at moving on, but instead at countering the absence created by death by re-evoking loss and attendant affect-laden memories. Commemorative ritual establishes a space of linkage of like subjects, indeed like mourners, and facilitates the construction of group memory. You go on to say, we don't structure sessions, analytic sessions, with commemoration as a goal. Acts of doing have a very small place in psychoanalytic work. We abhor, there's the word again, we abhor what's prescribed, including the deliberate evocation of specific affect states and memories, or explicit attempts to stimulate intragroup connectedness. Indeed, analytic ritual aims to minimize externally generated evocation and maximize access to interior experience. You write, commemorative rituals are analytically seen as an underlying and problematic resistance to facing loss, a resistance to be analyzed rather than enacted. And yet, you conclude, I suspect that acts of memorialization evoke a core psychoanalytic anxiety, that we never do lose our need for the other or our need to rework old connections, that we cannot fully separate, cannot fully terminate. Joyce, you want to flesh this out for us?
I mean, I feel so strongly about this. I think that early psychoanalytic writing really overemphasized the value of separation, individuation, and minimized or pathologized the opposite. And it's been through personal experience that I have come to see that in a different way. Personal experience, both with regard to, I'm Jewish, with regard to Jewish commemorative ritual, which takes place a couple of times a year, but also some experiences that I had outside the realm of religion. And the one that pops to mind because it happened not that long ago was what President Biden did in about a year after the first onslaught of the COVID epidemic, which was that he had candles put all around the reflecting pool in DC. And I think one candle for every, I don't know, number of people who had died. And this was broadcast on television. Now, maybe because I hadn't actually lost anybody to COVID, so I had a little bit thicker skin, but I sat there and first I wept, thousands of deaths, right? Mm-hmm. And then I began to think about the power of the experience of mourning with other like subjects. Because despite the fact that we all had lost whomever we lost, we didn't all lose the same person, We had all lost somebody to this virus that was not as yet being managed. And there was something incredibly powerful about that, in the same way that I have been told people who lost somebody in 9/11 go down to the Twin Towers and read the list of names every year. We don't know how to theorize this stuff, but I think it's time that we did.
And you say it beautifully and more elaborately than we had a moment to read. I'd like you to read for us the last paragraph in the book, and then I'm going to ask you a bit about yourself. We're talking about page 202 at the bottom.
Yep. And so I end, this means I end the book, with the credo that has guided me across a professional lifetime. Whatever the particulars of your psychoanalytic ideal, find and hold firmly to the business you're in, one grounded in an ethic of care. Hold your theory lightly and do your best to remain open to its limitations. Study, question, doubt. Try to retain an ethical stance when expediency would invite you to close your eyes or give in to desire. Above all, enact that desire by aiming to offer yourself, your wisdom, and your care for your patients ahead of your beliefs, your rules and desires, and your theory, while simultaneously acknowledging the impossibility of this ideal.
And your work, such that I can gather from studying this book carefully over time, really evidences the ideal, the missing the ideal, and an intense ongoing curiosity about the nature of that space between the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
Which leads me to you.
Yes.
So what are you doing here? By that I mean, what you've written a book on the unspoken, the areas that we don't talk about, with high regard for the gift that we are involved in for our patients and for ourselves in helping them to discover aspects of their minds that they didn't even know exist, much less be able to speak of, which is something remarkable that we're able to do. But what's your personal story?
Oh, well, I've got more than one.
Don't we all, right?
Can't give them all, but I'll give you some major points. Perhaps most dominant for me is the fact that I had two psychoanalyst parents and a third psychoanalyst step-parent, so I kind of grew up with this stuff, for better and worse. I came to feel a couple of different things. One, that I wanted to find a way to bridge the gap or the space between different theoretical positions. For me, that was the Freudian position that was represented by all of my three parents, and what I became drawn to as a younger clinician, which was the interpersonal, relational, self-psychological group of orientations. I wanted people to stop fighting. I'm not a fan of fighting. I tend to be a little conflict averse. So I wanted to see whether there was a way to bridge that. And I did my best to do that in the stuff that I wrote on holding. Another story that I believe is in the book, but I will tell it because I think it was so powerful in my own development that I'll never forget it. My mother was the president of IPTAR, okay, which may tell you something right there. She was...
A lot of people won't know what IPTAR
Institute
is.
It's a New York Freudian Institute, the Institute for Psychoanalytic Training and Research. And in the years when she was president, it was pretty conservative. I think that has changed, but it was pretty conservative in those days. And she was a rule follower. And one day she mentions to me that she's helping her patient get an abortion. And I, all of 14, already knew, being the child of analysts, that you're not allowed to do that. So I said, but you're not allowed to do that. And my mother said to me, either we are in the business of helping people or we are not. And it was one of those statements, so transparently simple or apparently simple, that stayed with me across a lifetime. Because what she was saying there was, I hold my theory lightly. When I'm addressing human need, I meet the need, and then I worry about my theory. And I can stand by that, even though I also recognize that, you know, one can be self-deluded and do something in the best interest of the patient that is actually not in the best interest of the patient, but rather in one's own best interest. So it's not as simple. I mean, it sounds simple. It's not so simple.
But the implication is that the question of how best to help a patient isn't always, if at all, best located in theory.
Yes, absolutely. And I feel like I stand by that, and that I would use that as a guide before I would use any psychoanalytic theory as a guide.
Implying that you would also, this may go without saying, also stay attuned to the implications and meanings and reverberations in the patient of whatever action you took in their, devoted to their well-being. That it's not just a good deed, it's an enactment that... Yes. will be present for some long time in their mind.
Yes, as would be one's refusal.
Totally.
Which is why I think there is no exit. You know, I wrote this someplace else in the book. I had a patient, I was in supervision with a really lovely Freudian, but quite rigid. Her name was Shirley Feltman. She's died some time ago. I loved her, but she was rigid and she wanted to teach me how to do psychoanalysis. So when my analytic patient, who was a training case, asked me if she could go away with her new boyfriend for 3 months over the summer, Shirley said she can't do that. Either she's in analysis or she's not. I was, you know, 12 years old, so I told my patient, you can't do it if you want to do a training analysis, and the treatment never recovered. And when I look back on that now, that was just plain old stupid. I should have analyzed it. What if I say yes? Sure. What would you get? What would you lose? What if I say no? There's so much to analyze there that you lose when you just stick to the rules, and that you lose when you just flout the rules.
And that is the theme that I've come to so enjoy and respect about your thinking and your writing, that you're attentive to both sides without bringing forward a moralistic or, quote, sinful position. And you're endlessly curious. And I can't recommend this book highly enough. It's called Psychoanalysis and the Unspoken. Joyce, it has been a pleasure and a privilege to get to know you and your thinking. And I recommend it to our listeners.
I thank you, Harvey. It's been a delight to be interviewed by you also, because you're really good at this.
I enjoyed it too.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.